my condition was ill.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
You talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al. Ricky on the board. S&P futures are down 32. NASDAQ futures are down 322. So we have had this up, down, up, down, up, down. Yesterday we were way up on the Micron news, like 700-800 in NASDAQ futures. Then we went down 200 or 300 at one point during the day. Came back in and we finished up, I believe, 3 somewhere in there, and now we're down that 3. So I guess that puts us at even for the last couple of days. But some stocks are just getting pummeled. One of the things that I've been watching for a while, I have no real way to put my finger on the pulse of, and maybe Kevin can help with this. What exactly, at the end of the day, we've had people on, we had John Flynn's son, we've had people on talking about crypto and Bitcoin and real believers, and we had some non-believers, and we got all that stuff, but I still cannot get my hands around, and maybe I'm just not looking in the right spot, or maybe Kevin can help, but I can't get my hands around how important it is to maintain this value in terms of world economics. I mean, what's the danger if it goes? I mean, I've seen this MicroStrategies, which is 300 and something, now it's 83.91, 84. They became just a crypto company. They used to do other stuff. And they're supposedly heavily leveraged on Bitcoin. Now, I don't know if it's corporate bonds, whether it's equity, whether they actually have gotten margin loans from somebody. If you look at a place like Robinhood or Coinbase, I'm not exactly sure where they get their margin loans. I don't think... If we had a client that wanted to buy Bitcoin, that our normal way of doing things, doing the RBC or IB, where you immediately can get a margin loan for IBM or Amazon or something, I don't know if that comes from the same place. There seems to be somewhat of a mystery around this whole thing, or maybe I'm just not digging deep enough, but at one point I think the total value of Bitcoin around the world was, Bitcoin and other stuff, was around $3 trillion. And now I think it's somewhere under $1.4 trillion or $1.3 trillion. Now, I don't know what pockets in this world that there, you know, people in this certain area have all their value in Bitcoin. Other areas don't. Whether it's drug money, I mean, Kevin, can you add anything to this? I don't really know. Do you?
Yeah, no, I have nothing to add to it. I'm not involved in it, and I don't pay very close attention to it.
I don't either. I just wonder if all of a sudden.
I get a notice from Coinbase telling me, the value is down another 5% every day. So,
well, if you had to guess, I got Bitcoin at 59,000. It topped out at what, like 110 or something, maybe 120. If that number is 45, does that mean MicroStrategy's out of business? Does that mean some countries in deep doo-doo? Does it mean Iran's in trouble? I mean, does it mean all the people who have expatriated to Puerto Rico here that had all this Bitcoin money and don't want to pay taxes, that mean they're moving back? I mean, I can't put my finger on any of that stuff. Do you, you know, maybe it's just not there. I don't know.
Well, it's magic money. It's been there for a while. We've You know, you've talked about it a lot on the show. I've told you on the show a lot that I don't particularly care about it. So.
Well, I don't care about it either because I don't have any. Okay, but I mean, it's you know, our job, me managing money and doing the show. I mean, you know, what if somebody asks either one of them, hey, what if things opens up tomorrow at 10,000? Who gets hurt?
Well, they ain't gonna ask me.
Yeah, they might. What if I tell a few students that's what you want to ask Kevin the next class?
Yeah, I'm going to tell them the same thing I'm telling you. Don't know.
All right, well. Anyway, I have a couple of...
No, not giving out financial advice in class, so...
Well, there you go. All I know is when my bro got his... He bought $20 worth of Bitcoin probably 10 years ago on a vending machine. And I think the machine took $4, so he only really got $16 worth. I think he lost his password, so I don't know. I don't know if he's up or down. I don't think he does either. You ever see one of those machines? They're pretty sweet. I mean, they're like an ATM machine on steroids. You can pay your bills in there and everything. I mean, they're big, huge things. I don't think three guys can carry those out the front door like they do the other ones. Just saying. Hey, I got a question for a couple of baseball questions. In terms of, they're not really baseball questions. I guess they're mindset questions and how people's mindset can really change over time. And one of the questions here is why did Nolan Ryan never win a Cy Young? And of course, this guy launches into back in those days. Nolan Ryan was obviously a spectacular pitcher for a long time, but his wins over losses were never that huge, 324 to 292. And every year that he had a great year, somebody had a spectacular year as well. One year was Jim Palmer, next year was Catfish Hunter, and those kinds of things, and how basically saying how people in those days were so dumb to think that winning games was, you know, the most important thing. And, you know, now we've, of course, lobbed into this whole mentality of quality starts, and if you go six innings, and which I don't really have a problem with, Kevin, but I guess the mentality is so different. I mean, for a guy I know I pitched softball for 40 years, but I pitched in doubleheader leagues. And sometimes you had the wind blowing out, and your job was to win 15 to 10, and then you turn around and the wind was blowing in, and your job was to win 4 to 2. But whatever it was, your job was to give up less runs than the other guy. But I couldn't turn around at a wind blowing inside, give up 5 runs, and say, hey, you idiots lost the game, I gave you a quality start. That fish didn't swim. When did we get to the point where if I'm going up against Bob Gibson and I know he's going to give up 2 runs or at worst, that I can give up 5 and pat myself on the back? Isn't the idea to beat Bob Gibson on that day? Or what am I missing? Am I just getting old?
Well, yes, you are getting old. Yeah. You've got old. In fact, you know, you've been old for a long time.
That's true. Yeah, it didn't just happen in one day.
Let's dispel that part of the equation. In those days, wins versus losses was way more valued than it is now. But that was a longstanding criticism of Ryan, that as good as he could be at times, and you know, when you throw as many no-hitters and one-hitters and so on as he did, you could tell that he was unhittable at times. That there were other times when he wasn't. And there were and that he was on the margins, that there were better pitchers in his day than him. So that was a long-standing criticism. I think he was a terrific pitcher. I don't really have I don't necessarily share that criticism, but I don't know, what do you want?
Well, sometimes you just run into a year where what do you do when you run up against Steve Carlton? And the guy, somebody else, you can be a situation where the other team, the other guy, there's 3 years in a row where people just were lights out. Doesn't mean you were bad. just means...
No, but, again, you got to compare him to the other pitchers of his day, too. And I think that's how you always compare baseball players of different eras. Yes, he would run up against some really, really great pitchers. But that was standard procedure, is they would line them up. If you've ever heard Fergie Jenkins interviewed, for example, they said, you know, they would just line them up. They were playing the Cardinals, he was going to pitch against Gibson. If they were playing Cincinnati, he was going to pitch against Jim Maloney. If they were going to, you know, and you could go down, you could tick down the list of that they were always going to line him up against the best pitchers of his day. And yet Ferguson Jenkins won 300 games, and Ferguson, you know, so... You know, you get the point. They're comparing him to the pitchers of his day. Like I said, as good as he could be sometimes, Tom Seaver was a better pitcher, came up through the same system, through, I think, one no-hitter, and he threw it with the White Sox.
Yeah.
In his life. But I don't think there's anybody that thinks that Nolan Ryan was a better pitcher than Tom Seaver.
They were, I'm not so sure it was that much different. They were just kind of different style.
Seaver, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a...
And maybe that's part of it. You know, maybe that's part of, that created a certain limitation to him.
Well, sometimes...
Because he could be wild, especially in the younger part of his career, he could be really wild.
Well, sometimes when you look at even some of the bats, you'll see some guy who wasn't alive at the time will write in, well, how come this team didn't win, like, four NBAs in a row if they were so good? Well, because they were going against the Lakers and the Celtics. And I mean, there are times when there's... I mean, I don't know what you... I mean, I wasn't talking about...
The Knicks that could never get past the Bulls.
Yeah. You know, you know what?
Patrick Knicks were a very good team. They were a really good team.
The issue with that was... I mean, I was a massive Bull fan in those days. And Billy Hake and I would run down to Samaries and watch the game in gritty black and white from Chicago. And Kevin, was it $1.35 pitchers or juries and 59-cent meatball sandwiches? I think it was. Anyway, the Bulls were set up.
Oh, well, it was cheap, but it was juries.
It was jury. As long as it was cold, it was drafted, it was okay. What do we need? Heineken's?
Envy, by the way.
The Bulls were set up. They had two terrific forwards. Center was a passing forward. Tom Bornickel was a high post center. And he had two defensive-minded but pretty good guards. Whenever they went up against a team, the only teams that really gave them trouble were teams that had Wilt or had Jabbar on their teams, or Bill Walton. They were the three premier centers at the time. And they had trouble with them. That's why they couldn't beat the Lakers. They had trouble against Portland. But they murdered the Knicks because... Bob Love at that point was better than Dave DeBuscher because he was earlier in his career. And Chet Walker was a way better player than Bill Bradley. We're not even close, I don't think. Not that Bill Bradley wasn't a great man and a great senator or anything else, but the fact is Chet was a hell of a lot better player. So that year that the Knicks won in 73, I think they beat the Lakers. If the Bulls would have got by the Lakers, they would have murdered the Knicks, I think. That's just saying, but it's 73.
Well, the Bulls later on got to the championship game against the Warriors, and that was, Barry. Barry, come on, give me his first name, because he's only a Hall of Fame player.
Warriors, you're not Rick Barry.
Rick Barry, thank you. So that was Rick Barry, but they had Clifford Ray at center.
Yeah.
Cliff Ray
was 6'9", 6'10".
But when the Bulls got Nate Thurman, they thought, you know, they didn't need, that was all part of the same trade. So, they traded Clifford Ray for Nate Thurman. The Bulls thought they had him. In fact, they had a lead in the series, and then they came back, and Ray was terrific. So that vintage of Bulls, their problem was it wasn't just Wilt, it was some really good players, including I don't know if Keith Wilkes was Jamal by then, but that team had Wilkes, had Barry, had some really good players of their own.
I think so. Wasn't Wilkes on the he was in the Lakers, wasn't he?
He spent most of his career on the Lakers, but he started out in the Warriors.
Okay, well, the other question is, and I'm not, taking a shot at today's baseball, though maybe I will. But these numbers here are really spectacular, Kevin. The question is, what major league player had the highest home run to strikeout ratio in a season? There's a guy named Joe Sewell, 1932. stepped to the plate 576 times for the Yankees, hit 11 homers and struck out 3 times. I mean, 11 home runs is not, you know, exactly make you a power hitter, but the...
What year was that?
1936. But by 1945, the Boston Braves, the this was pitching staffs that were deleted by World War II, but basically some of these guys were the greatest contact sluggers in baseball history. Joe DiMaggio had his legendary 1941 season. He had 30 home runs and struck out 13 times. Yogi Berra's best ratio came in 1950, 28 home runs and 12 strikeouts. Today, if you have 30 home runs, you strike out 150 times, they think you're okay. That's a massive difference in watching the game as a fan, because that means 138 more times than Yogi, somebody walks back to the plate and you don't even get to see any defense or anything.
My baseball preference is always making contact. It's one thing if you, if you swing and miss, if you strike out, if you're Kyle Schwarber as an example. Kyle Schwarber doesn't swing at crap. He has a really, and he did when he was with the Cubs. It was one of their concerns about him. He had a very high swing and miss rate, always did. That was considered a problem, obviously not that big a problem because he's been so successful. But it affects his batting average. But his on-base percentage is incredibly high because he takes his walks. He doesn't swing at crap. And to me, that's the biggest. That's always my beef with the way a lot of hitters are. It isn't. I would rather they make contact, but if they don't, they shouldn't fail to make contact because they chased a pitch a foot and a half outside.
I agree. Plus,
that's actually the adjustment that Pete Crow Armstrong has made suddenly, and he's already got more walks than he had all last year. Just in the last 4 to 5 weeks, something like that, during this hot streak, he finally, and they've been talking about it, for a while. It's a very conscious thing that he's trying not to chase too much, not to chase bad pitches.
You see him thrown out on the walk the other night?
Yeah.
That was wild.
I knew right away what the call was. I got it. The announcers couldn't figure it out, but I was on that completely. I said, "You are totally entitled to the base on a walk, but as soon as you touch the base, you can't step off of it. You can't. It would be like if you took the walk. If you just jogged down there because of the walk. If he weren't running." He would not be able to stand on the base and then step off if the shortstop was standing right there with the ball. The shortstop would be entitled to tag him out. That play was no different, other than the fact that he was running. He was trying to steal the base. He didn't. It proved to be unnecessary, and as a result, as soon as he was off the base, then he was subject to being tagged out, and he was. I don't know that that I would call it heads up in terms of by the opposing shortstop. I don't know that I would call it a real heady play, in that that he knew all along was going on. But he did, like they always do now. He did stick with the tag all the way through the play. Then when they said, "Well, it was a it was ball four, so no play there," and he, I don't know if it was the shortstop or the manager or somebody on the other team was smart enough to say, "Hey, wait a minute, there's something else we need to check," and that's how they got him.
A couple of quick history questions here. I seem to recall, and again, this is not like I've got baseball replays etched in my mind. I seem to recall that when it was a ball four before, the fielder, somewhat gentlemanly, if he saw that it was ball four, would act in a manner where the guy didn't slide. Now, I wonder if the fact that people can now appeal that call has changed that, whatever gentlemanly stuff might have been there. And secondly, if he goes to steal second and the guy gets the walk, and all of a sudden the guy appeals and it really was strike three or something, what happens to him? I mean, if he stole it legitimately, I guess he stays there, right? I mean,
and I don't know how they would interpret that play, but I'd imagine because everybody played it out live that he would be awarded the outcome for the stolen base. But I can't swear to that. I don't know what the rule says about it.
But I seem to recall it's like the second baseman.
The appeal is virtually immediate. So, on the swing. So I don't think it would have disrupted anything.
I wonder if these dudes, to me, and this is just a guy watching the game, it seems to me that the appeals have essentially made the strike zone bigger.
Well, I don't think so at all.
Why?
Because I just don't observe it.
I mean, I do. I mean, I think I do. And what I'm saying is, I mean, everybody kind of knew that. I think everybody kind of knew that the rule was any part of the ball in the strike zone. But there have been pitches that I think are obvious balls, and all of a sudden that are pretty much unhittable, and they'll do a replay, and like a millionth of an inch of the ball hits like the top outside corner, and you sit there and go, "You can't hit that thing." I mean, it seems like it's given the strike zone maybe another half inch all the way around. Because nobody would have bitched at the ump from calling that thing a ball last year. Because you see some of these in the lower...
On broadcasts, they used to say, not egregious. That was how they would look at it, versus the one that was 3 inches outside, and they would say, that's egregious. But no, I don't think it's changed the way the umpires call it. Well, what it has done is it has really diminished the amount of framing you see. I think there's still catchers that try to do their framing and move the ball, but I think the best they can hope to do on that, as long as the other team has a challenge left, I think the best they can hope to do is to force them to use up a challenge. and if they're right or if they're wrong, it might be using up a challenge. It might not.
Yeah, man. It just seems like every time you do something, things have sort of an unintended consequence. I mean, and the ball has some size to it. I've seen some where we're talking about, really, just the dirt on the ball is what's causing the thing to be a strike, and you sit there and go, "Boy, I look pretty outside to me." I mean, if I'm a batter, anyway. What do you suppose got into this? What kind of vitamin pill did they give our Danzy Swanson?
I don't know, but I think he was 0 for yesterday, so he ran out.
He hit the ball hard a couple times, though. That was a pretty good game yesterday.
He was bound to hit better, but it's been a while. I think his first year with the Cubs, he was a better hitter than... he was a better hitter than he has been every year since then. But he shouldn't be a 180 hitter.
But when he was hitting 180, I thought they'd have to send him down to Arizona to recreate his swing or something. He was looking awful.
Well, I believe in the numbers that most guys, whether they start off, really cold, or they start off really hot, I think most players by the end of the season get somewhere close to their numbers, to their historical numbers. I think they just do. Some guys start off hot and then they get back to their historical numbers. And then there are some who might start off really cold and then they'll get, for a half a season, they'll get their numbers, which doesn't bring their whole season all the way back, but it brings, they start to perform. When a guy's been in Major League Baseball for a long time, until he gets to the age where his skills start to diminish, you're pretty much going to see the same player every year. And that's, I think we'll see that out of Bregman at some point, who has been disappointing so far. But Alex Bregman is going to start hitting like Alex Bregman, which is a...
Well, I didn't save this other one. I got one more for you, and then we'll start talking about the world.
Yeah, because I want to talk about Fauci and pardons.
Let's do that. You know, let's give me some. I recall that guy's name back during the AIDS issue, because it was kind of a big thing here in Chicago, and there was a couple guys in the trading floor that I thought were pretty good guys, and all of a sudden, boy, if you died of AIDS originally, man, that was just an awful sentence. It was basically the same as like blood cancer or something, wasn't it? I mean, it was pretty bad. I mean,
quickly, I know Carl is a little more attuned into that than I am. So, Carl, you may want to jump in and just explain what happened with Fauci and AIDS. But
I'm trying to get to where did he come from?
But I want to go back to Fauci and Biolabs, which is more recent.
Okay, but I guess what I'm trying to say is we need to set. It wasn't like he started with COVID. He's been around for God bless him. I started on. He's been around since Reagan. I mean, how old is the guy?
Years is a high level guy.
But he started out just a regular doctor. Was he a university professor or what? Or just an appointee of somebody?
Yeah, I don't know. He's a bureaucrat. What can you say?
Well, he must have been a doctor somewhere.
Well, I suppose we can look up what, if you've been wondering, and just look him up.
Well, okay. Well, go on. You've obviously got something to say. Go ahead.
Well, what's significant about the pardon that was granted to Fauci?
I don't know what anybody on any of these pardons. I have questions on all of it. Go ahead.
His pardon goes back to 2014. So let's back up the train a little bit. Last week I told you what the Trump easing of Obama's ban on gain of function research. But in fact, Obama's ban wasn't really an outright ban. Effectively, it was an outsourcing of gain of function research to other countries. And a lot of it still got funded by the United States. As we have learned with Fauci, it was laundered through third-party organizations like EcoHealth Alliance and to countries like Ukraine and like China and so on. So there were 120 biolabs total that were still operating, and 40 of those were in Ukraine. This was very much...
Can you explain better than me what gain of function is? It's essentially trying to create...
You take a virus, see if you can accelerate it into a more serious virus, which you might do to create a bioweapon, in which, at least theoretically in the benign sense, is to further understand and be able to combat what might happen if the virus accelerated on its own and we needed to combat it, which
if some horrible
benign, but yeah. most of this was very CIA involved, Russia had a whole series of biolabs in Ukraine, and the Western countries just took those over. That's where the research was going on.
But the CIA / whatever bullshit for guys like us was, we're trying to get ahead of the fact that if some horrible virus comes out of a cave in China or somewhere in Africa, we're going to be ahead of it and we're going to be able to take care of it. Isn't that the BS version?
That would be your in theory version, yes. Yeah. So this, Obama had a temporary halt on federal funding. There was a voluntary moratorium, so researchers were asked to voluntarily pause any ongoing non-federally funded studies. And so what that meant was, instead of the federal government directly funding it, if we sent money to a third party, the third party was technically not funding, not the government funding, and therefore... They were asked to voluntarily pause, which they didn't. Okay, so that's it. So what happened in 2014 that was significant?
Okay, was there anything special about this particular lab in China, which is one of a bunch?
No. In terms of how the U.S. operated,
yeah.
How the funding, no, it was one of a bunch.
But the one in China wasn't doing CIA stuff. I can't imagine. Maybe they were. It just seems odd. I would think the Ukraine ones would be more set up for that.
They were.
Okay, so, right.
So 2014, the Ukraine coup, officially known as the Revolution of Dignity. mass student protests, civil protests in Kyiv that culminated in the Ukrainian parliament ouster of pro-Russian president Viktor, and I can't pronounce his name, Yanukovych, who fled the country, and instead Poroshenko came in.
Which was the guy with the huge palace? Was ever both of those guys?
What's that?
Which one of those guys had the huge palace?
I don't know. Not relevant to the story.
There is
an oligarch who is relevant to the story. Right. I'll get to that.
All right.
So this happened at the very least with U.S. involvement, and that was, you know, Victoria Nuland and Alexander Vindman. Those are the usual names, and you will, you know, they show up through a lot of anything involved with Ukraine. So the U.S. has been credibly accused with orchestrating it to have a controllable pro-Western government.
And these guys are in the CDC, or where are they? These two names you just lobbed out.
Nuland is a career diplomat.
Okay, so he's not even in the CDC. Okay.
And Vindman was the ambassador there.
Yeah. Okay.
So there is actually. There's actually some audio available with Nuland and Pyatt from one of the high-ranking people in Ukraine discussing all of the preferred leadership appointments.
There's a web of, I'll use the term coordination. It's a bad term between our guys, the Ukraine guys, and these labs.
We're getting there.
All right.
Okay. So the Obama administration's designated point man on Ukraine, effective March of 2014, was VP Joe Biden.
Okay.
And in May, Joe Biden's son Hunter and his partner Devin Archer were appointed to the board of Burisma. And very shortly after that was when, and this again, you know, Biden bragged about this Council on Foreign Relations appearance a year or two later, he forced the Poroshenko to immediately fire General Viktor Shokin the prosecutor general, Viktor Shokin. Shokin was investigating Burisma, and Biden bragged about it and said he was withholding money. He was visiting Ukraine. He was supposed to sign over a very large government loan from the United States government, and he told them, he told them unless they fired this prosecutor, he was leaving and they wouldn't get the money. And as he said in his video, he said, "Well, son of a bitch, before I got on the plane, they had him fired." So, that was his wording. Now we'll get to why that's significant, but this is where Joe Biden's involvement in all of this stuff that's going on in Ukraine, which includes the biolabs. So if you fast forward 2 years to 2016, Trump had won the election. He was president-elect, and he's on a phone call with Poroshenko, and now he's worried about what's going on here, because, as it turns out, let's see, I haven't gotten to the Hunter part yet, but he's telling him that this is getting very, very close to what I don't want to have happen. This is recording. It's available in the general. I don't want Trump to get in a position where he thinks he's about to buy onto a foreign policy where the financial system is going to collapse and he's going to be looked at to pour more money into Ukraine. That's how he'll think about it before he gets sophisticated enough to know the detail. So what he's saying is, if we're going to pour a bunch more money into Ukraine, then Trump's going to look into what's going on with it, and he'll figure out all of the stuff that we have going on here. He didn't want Ukraine asking Trump for more economic aid because that would cause Trump to look into the details of the Biden's business in Ukraine.
It doesn't sound like there's any connection between that and Wuhan.
We're getting there. We're getting there because Fauci gets into this too. So he said, anything you can do to push the private bank closure so that they can get an IMF loan, and he would respectfully suggest that it is critically important to your economic as well as physical security, which sort of sounds like a threat. So now we go, why January 2014? Because that's Hunter Biden's his pardon as well as Fauci's. And so we have all these bio labs in Ukraine. Fauci appointed research to Eco Health Alliance, which was a Wuhan project, and that's his guy, Peter.
Who gave Fauci the pardon?
Joe Biden, okay. Last day of his administration. So now we have the two guys' business dealings in Ukraine overlapping, and therefore the 2014 pardon is significant. So when we start talking about lies about Wuhan, it goes back farther than that with Fauci.
Like I say, it goes back to AIDS, my opinion. But
well, yeah, but in that case, and again, Carl knows a little bit more about this with the AIDS stuff. I don't know that there is the same that his behavior could be considered criminal, but I don't know that it was criminal unless you have quid pro quos for the treatments that Fauci was proposing. I don't want to get off track on that because that's not tied to this.
But this appears to be some huge goat bleep with the Ukrainian government and everybody. I don't think the Chinese were up there behind to this extent in China. It's totally different, isn't it?
No, but let me keep going. So,
yeah, but the thing didn't escape from Ukraine.
So Daszak had a partner company called Metabiota. Metabiota had been shut down in China because it was too sloppy and too dangerous. So now we're saying somebody had to replace Metabiota, which became Eco Health Alliance in China. So that's where the Fauci connection on the gain-of-function research into China all of a sudden at Wuhan gets back into play here. Is Metabiota is shut down. That's a partner company with Fauci's buddy, Peter Daszak. Daszak redirects the Daszak research money for Wuhan to Eco Health Alliance instead.
So this is private money.
No, it's government money being laundered through a 401c something or other company.
Well, if somebody labs an executive order out there, whatever it is, whoever it is, and says, okay, we're not going to do gain of function research, and one of us decides, okay, guess what? We love gain of function research, and we send a check to Wuhan. What does it even mean? They haul us into court, maybe, if they don't like us. We see enough of that. And all of a sudden the judge goes, where the hell is the law? Where's the penalty? What are we talking about here? That's what I don't get about any of this stuff.
Well, I understand that you don't get it. I'm telling you what happened.
Okay.
You keep interrupting, so I can't tell you what happened.
But I'm saying I don't... The Hunter Biden situation had nothing to do with China. They didn't pay the guy.
But it did, because this was all about operating the labs, and I'm about to get to that. So now you have this nexus between with Peter Daszak, bio labs in Ukraine, where he redirected his Metabiota business, and instead took his Eco Health Alliance stuff to China, and so now you have the Wuhan lab continuing to do what it always did. And who was there to ensure that Metabiota's success getting U.S. support for its work in Ukraine was Hunter. In fact, correspondence found buried and documented on Hunter's laptop, said specifically, as promised, I prepared the attached memo, which provides an overview of Metabiota, our engagement in Ukraine, and how we can potentially leverage our team, networks, and concepts to assist Ukraine's cultural and economic independence from Russia and continued integration into Western society. Metabiota has engaged Hunter as well. And as we know, if you engaged Hunter, you had engaged Joe. Because Hunter always represented Joe. Now you have it. So then there is the line. So Fauci's, you know, lies. He denied funding gain-of-function research, which was going on in both Wuhan and in Ukraine. He denied any research coordination with U.S. intelligence, which is not true. He engineered the investigation after the fact in Wuhan by putting all of his people on the...
What is his motivation? Is he just a huge...
team? His common email opening to different people, which has been recovered, was destroy this after you read it, and they work to discredit anybody who said it was a lab leak out of Wuhan. So you see this whole nexus of what was going on with government people and Fauci and this gain-of-function research network. And it goes beyond just Wuhan. It is all over different countries, because if you go back to the executive order, it's the executive order said voluntary pause requested of these non-government organizations, and of course we know that if the government funded the non-NGO, then the NGO could voluntarily not stop too.
Well, anything executive order appears to be somewhat voluntary, but what is Fauci's motive? Did he actually believe this stuff was that important? I mean, it doesn't sound like he got rich on the deal.
I think he has ownership in a lot of the...
Well, but I'm saying is, what would motivate somebody to do that? Did he actually think... I know he went down the road, every road he possibly could, to get an AIDS vaccine, that he was absolutely convinced that that was a solution there when it really wasn't. Is it the same kind of motivation that's just what he believes?
Yeah, who had rights to some of the patents on some of this stuff? Just like who had rights for mRNA? That part of that was the organizations he controlled, and so it becomes a power thing. He may very well believe that gain-of-function research was important, and and there isn't a damn person who can tell him anything else, and he won't be told. That's, you know, part of his mindset. But I have no doubt that he was enriched in some way with this.
Well, it sounds like it. It almost seems like every time something like this happens, there's this tangled web, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, and... You know, and so part of that was the vice president, and I know because there's also, you know, some messaging around the Obama administration that they were very concerned about, you know, what was going on with Biden and with his family, and not just, you know, not just Hunter, his brother Jim too, in other parts of the world, that the influence there and what was going on with that should have been a concern. And they, you know, they did what they could to try and tamp it down.
Well, I mean, it's sort of
because they didn't want to be embarrassed by this. You know, I mean, telling you the Obama administration was pure as the driven snow, and saw Joe and said they were appalled by it or anything. They just thought he was reckless because he was Joe Biden, and Joe Biden was a blowhard. He would brag about anything that could happen.
You see this happen. You see this sort of happen. This is, I mean, worse, but, you know, years ago, Kevin, we had people that were doing some trading in oil and so forth. We never did the spot trading like Enron was doing. I mean, what do you do when, what's his name, Phil Graham's wife is on the board of Enron, and Phil Graham runs through, I don't even remember what party he was in. I think he was Republican, but it doesn't matter. What do you do about that? She's in charge of, you know.
Well, they should all go to jail. They absolutely should. I have no problem with the mindset. But you know, in this case, we're talking about, you know, something that recently happened. We're talking about the pardons, and we're talking about, you know, what was released about a week ago. That, you know, before she left office, what Tulsi Gabbard released. So this is current news. Enron is not current news, which is why I didn't bring it up. This is you know, this is current news. Fauci has been subpoenaed to Congress. It will be interesting. I would just like them to ask one simple question of him. Did you lie to Congress before? Because he's been granted immunity for that. He has been pardoned for any crime he may have committed. So he cannot plead the Fifth Amendment about that. He either has to answer truthfully, yes, I lied to Congress.
Kevin, how old is he? How old is he now? Do you have any idea?
Or it's probably, I don't know, 75, 80, something like that. He's an older guy. But if he says, yes, I lied to Congress, good, we have that answer. I don't know what will come of it, you know, because it was an auto pen, you know, a lot of the auto pen pirate pardons are being challenged. But the other side of that is, if he says, no, I never lied to Congress, then now he doesn't have immunity for what he says now. So if he goes into Congress now and lies, then he's in trouble.
Well, I mean, so, as you...
They'll ask him all kinds of stuff, but that should be the first question they ask him.
Well, and regarding, you know, the Hunter Biden thing, as you know, I have people that knew him when he was younger that said he was a creep then. We don't seem to... I know Enron was a long time ago, but I also know that we somehow haven't come to grips with the issue either. If somebody's family... If you became president and you had a wife, can we tell her she can't sit on a board? I don't think we know.
Well, I think it's difficult to tell a wife she can't have her own career. So, you know, I guess there's a problem. It all needs a lot of sunlight. The real question was, what kind of money was flowing and under what circumstance? Because we know, I mean, you know, this is all documented on Hunter's laptop. We keep saying Hunter. It's not a Hunter story. It's a Joe Biden story.
Right, so, fine, but I'm saying...
Stop interrupting me. There's a whole lot of money that was flowing back to the Biden family, and, you know, there's a really cool way to launder it. Hunter bitched nonstop about how much of Dad's bills he had to pay. He had to pay for the house. He had to pay for all of the, you know, recurring bills and all of that kind of stuff. It was millions of dollars. So if you want to launder money back without saying, I'm going to put money into the vice president's account, the easy way to do it is let it flow into his son's account and then let his son just spend the money directly on Dad's stuff.
Okay, I can name you four or five situations where this has happened, and I'm not using it to justify them. I'm just saying, how exactly do we deal with it? We didn't do it with, what's his name? Who's the senator, the old guy who's sick now? Who am I talking about? The guy, he was the head of the Senate forever. Mitch McConnell. His wife sat on the board of Bank of America or something at Wells Fargo when all the bad stuff was happening. I'm not using this to justify one or the other. And now we got Trump's kids doing the same thing. I don't want anybody's family doing this crap. I mean, I don't want Wendi Graham. There's people in Enron that went to jail, and she was the head of giving out the spankings for the bad people in the board. She never even got charged. I mean, this is. It sucks, Kevin, all along the way. But the part I don't get is if we can pin Hunter Biden at a wall, that doesn't justify anybody else, nor does it's your own job. If somebody else shoots a guy and you shoot a guy afterward, it's Hunter is a major problem. He was a major problem when he was a kid. He's a problem now. But he's not a justification for Trump's kids doing the same thing. They're on the board of people that do business with the government, too.
I repeat, it's not a Hunter story. It's a Joe story.
Same thing. You think Trump has nothing to do with it?
I know you hate whataboutism until you want to use it for that, and we can talk about all of those others one at a time. I'd be happy to, you know.
Okay, but you're not going
to
spend 45 minutes on Trump's kid. You're going to do it on Biden. That's a problem for me.
No, it's not a problem because this is really about Fauci, but you can't understand the Fauci story unless you understand why the pardon goes back to 2014 and what all was involved in Fauci's activities and where they crossed with others in the government.
I think there's
that, and that includes the CIA, that includes Victoria Nuland, that includes all of the others who were involved in this. That's, you can't understand what was going on with Fauci unless you do that. And that's why I covered it that way. I had no idea when I started looking into this. I had no idea what the nexus with the Biden family was going to be.
I'm not a bit surprised.
All I started doing was following up on what I told you last week about when Trump ended the about the Obama executive order. I said I started looking into it by saying what was in the executive order that Obama issued in the first place, and that was a little bit eye-opening. And then that started down a trail of, okay, well then, if you know, if he had all this voluntary stuff, then what was going on? Because if you look at Fauci and you look what was going on with that, this goes back to just specifically with Ukraine and with Wuhan, goes back into its origins are in the Obama administration. They were going on during the Obama years, and therefore you know that sort of raised an eyebrow. And so as I started digging into it a little bit more, you get your Fauci story.
By the way, it may not sound like it, but you just told me
I wasn't going looking for Joe Biden. But it was interesting that the paths crossed in there,
Kevin. Every time you dig, you find stuff that you're stunned at. What you've said today, it may not sound like it, but I tell you what, I know you did this research properly. You always do, and I am totally disgusted by this, and the connections in there. I guess I'm not shocked, but I'm disgusted by it. The only thing I'm kind of missing, and maybe we'll talk about this next week a little, because I think it's worth it. I don't see that the Maybe it did. I don't see how the Biden CIA Ukrainian government crooks, how that all transferred to Wuhan, because the Chinese are a totally different brand of bot. That seems like it would be a little different there. Maybe it wasn't. I mean, I don't know, but it seems to me that China's not going to let the CIA
moving around. Other than you know, the connection there is the Peter Daszak movement of different companies in one to Ukraine because the Chinese wouldn't let him operate, and then how he turned around and brought in a different shell to continue to do the same thing.
But
that little connection to Ukraine triggered a little bit more, and then looking at the pardon, then you say why does when you start asking why does Fauci's pardon go back to 2014, what was happening in 2014, and that's where the Ukraine changeover, that's where the Poroshenko coming in and the coup, that's where that comes in. That's not a coincidence that Fauci's involvement in there and in the biolabs in general, that's not a coincidence. That is, there's a reason that the pardon goes back to 2014, and that's why. And then all of a sudden, now you're asking the question, gee, Hunter's goes back to 2014 as well. All crimes from 2014 forward up until the day of the pardon, okay, what's going on here? And that's what starts me asking all these questions. And so Fauci is knee-deep in Ukraine as well as in Wuhan.
Okay, but my only point is, Kevin, and this, we need to do some research. The setup in China, Chinese government's not going to let anybody to put 100% of the money in there. Something's going on, they know about it. They're not going to let the CIA in there, I don't think. So, I mean, it has to be somewhat of a different setup of some kind.
Okay.
I mean, wouldn't you think? You're naming correctly. I think the crooked politicians in the Ukraine, I don't know that you can do that in China. They're crooked but different.
Okay.
You and I couldn't just open up a business in China and own 100% of it.
When you're looking at the Fauci pardon, all of a sudden you're saying, this isn't just about Wuhan anymore.
Okay, that part I get.
That's why the rest of it came up. And it really, I think other than the fact that the Wuhan lab was really poorly operated, and that when they say a virus escaped, what it really means is somebody got contaminated, went out into the public and contaminated others. It's not like a vial of a virus grew legs and snuck out the back door. That somebody got infected and started us down the road on this. That's sloppiness. But the cover up the reason Fauci needed to cover that up is because of his involvement in getting that funded. But now when we start saying, 2014, what was going on in 2014, what else was he covering
up?
That takes you into the Joe Biden conversation with Poroshenko, saying, we can't let Trump get a load of this. Because you got all this other biolab stuff.
So what was what was the Carolina connection?
Carl, would you chime in on that? Because you had posted something in the chat about UNC.
Oh, sure. Why not? So the UNC, as many people know, well, some people know anyway, has a rather active biological research facility with people of some note in that community. Okay, and I mean, okay, fine. You know, where do you think all the cancer research ultimately comes from, right? It's facilities like that. Okay, fine. They were involved in some of the stuff that Obama slammed fingers in the door on. All right, from a standpoint of NIH grants and stuff like this. And then all of a sudden, magically, and how this ties back into them is magically, several months before COVID shows up in the United States, and coincidentally, gee, what a coincidence, almost exactly the numerical time that I was able to compute from the genomic drift between the strain that hit over in Italy, the one that hit in New York, and the one that hit out in Washington State in the United States. By the way, genomic drift is actually, depending on the type of virus, has a mathematical relationship. So,
yeah, it'd be a cool name for a rock band, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's actually kind of cool because...
Or a softball team.
Well, this also later came into play with Omicron. But anyway, the... Right about the time when that virus had to be out in the wild, from those calculations, which was October-ish.
Is this when they were still searching the open air market, trying to find an animal?
No, Chief. This was before any public knowledge that this thing was going on. Okay, so we're talking October of 2019. There was a technology transfer from China back into UNC. And guess what it was? It was what ultimately was used to fast-track and produce those shots. In other words, it was the actual viral sequence. Now,
what they gave to the seven companies and said, go and make a vaccine.
And by the way, how do you magically discover something that supposedly doesn't exist yet because it hasn't yet?
So all the chasing it through the animals was all bullshit.
It was all bullshit, and oh, by the way, we knew that, and I pointed it out as soon as those technology transfer stuff showed up and as soon as the sequencing data was in the public data banks. So we're talking like March and April of 2020. I set out a series of articles on this. It was one of the reasons I got thrown off basically every social media site and everywhere else.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't go against the party line.
Oh, absolutely not. But you know what? Mathematics is an exact science. It's never wrong. And it pointed directly to what had happened and that our government and our research institutes within our educational system, within our post-secondary system, were up to their necks in all of it. It wasn't just in Ukraine and labs there and labs in Wuhan. It was also people here in the U.S.
Well, it was the big... It would have got out anyway, but the big outbreaks were in Milan because of the back and forth on the fabric trade, right?
There was a lot of traffic between Wuhan and into Italy.
Yeah, well, because that's where the textile
got into.
But yeah, also well, the people right. here from the God, Kevin, was it the Boston Scientific Conference where they had two or three super spreaders came from Europe to. The big stuff.
Yeah, it was, I mean, this is the nature of airplanes, right?
Yeah.
People travel, but this was something that once those sequences started to hit the public data banks, which happened pretty quickly, It was just a math problem in terms of, okay, wait a minute, the genomic drift is, you know, is this many generations down? All right, what is the turn time? Well, if I've got two samples, I can kind of guess. If I've got three or more,
give me a second. Didn't one person make it to Seattle or Vancouver, and then they tracked the person down, and before they tracked him down, they realized it wasn't the first person, it was the second, and the other person already there.
But that's how that happens.
Okay, that's what you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, is that the parent, daughter, son, relationship, grandparent, if you have the sequencing from somebody's, and we can do that kind of thing now. I mean, 50 years ago is impossible. Then, with computers today, it's not really all that tough. You can look at the drift across a couple of generations. If you have a few cases that you know who started it, right? All right, I've got something, I give it to you. Both of those get sequenced and go into a data bank. Now I've got a timeline. If I've got several of them, and I can look at the drift in the genomic reassortment that happens as disease gets passed between people, I can tell you when it had to have originated. And now that doesn't tell me how far back. It tells me what the forward barrier is, though. So what we knew at that point was that this thing had to be in the wild in October of 2019. We didn't know how much further back, maybe, because without a sample, you don't know. But we knew it was in the wild in October 2019, and it was deliberately covered up. And everybody's like, oh, no, this thing just started from this leak out of this market in February. Bull crap.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it then.
Yeah, and we were talking about it then, Chief. And the thing is that, this, boy, if you brought anything like that up, you got silenced, because the thing is that the so-called, wet market garbage was absolutely dependent upon that timeline holding up. If you have a transfer of technology, of actual genetic sequence data, into the United States from before this thing exists, obviously somebody's lying.
But this happened a couple other times in the last 10, I was asking Kevin the other day. There was a disease before that, a virus before that. They immediately tracked, the people who know how to do this crap, they immediately tracked through camels. And there was one before that they track through bat. It doesn't take people long in today's world to do that. When they couldn't find an animal, I'm going, wait a minute, this wasn't an animal, and I don't know anything about this stuff.
Well, and then diffuse and drastic managed to leak out of people that supposedly, and neither of those was actually classified. They were proposals to DARPA, and they came out of EcoHealth. And so, as a result, until something goes through or whatever. But, there's 1,000 grant proposals that are written, written all the time.
I guess if you could make a stab, I mean, Kevin just went through, it sounded like we were right. We weren't. I was just trying to get the information out of him, because I was fascinated by what he was saying, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people steal money from government all the time. And a lot of people, that's no justification. and families get involved. Again, no justification. It's wrong across the board. But this seems like, out of all the ways to do it, to come up with a few shekels, if you had to put your finger on it, what was the driving? Was it pure psychological, Dr. McCoy and the Enterprise, where you really want this knowledge and Fauci was absolutely, or was it the CIA? Was it weapons grade? What if you had to put your finger on what was the driver by all this? Where would you put
it, Chief? It's a hybrid, okay?
Okay.
And the reason is this. Pretty much forever, the holy grail of bioweapons research is to come up with something that your guys are genetically immune to. But it kills all your enemies' guys. Okay? That has been... And... The reason people think it can be done is, first off, it's extraordinarily arrogant. It's BS. I don't believe it's ever going to work, just based upon my understanding of biochemistry and such things. But, there's an awful lot of people that are true believers that this can be found. And the reason that they have that opinion is largely because of actual real-world lived experience. So, white man comes into the United States. There is a native population here. That native population has never, at any time in the past, since it came across from the Trans-Siberian Bridge, okay, or south from Mexico, and, you know, whatever, that native population has never seen a case of measles. White man, of course, coming over from Europe, measles was an endemic disease. And so some of the people that get on the boat and bring it over here, we bring over a few cases of measles. It gets into the Native American population, and it kills about a quarter of the people that get it.
I thought it was smallpox.
You know, well, that was even worse, okay? But measles, smallpox, same basic situation. Both of them did sometimes kill people that came, you know, European descent, okay? But the people of European descent have a genetic resistance to some extent for these diseases. So they get them. Sometimes they get whacked by it, but what was observed is that the fatality rate among people that were entirely naive to this strain of whatever was ridiculously higher. So from this, you have this hypothesis that gets formed that we can engineer a bioweapon with our so-called superior intellect, you know, our Genghis Khan kind of thing, that if the time comes, we're, say, at war with the Chinese, we can release this thing into China, and oh, by the way, it'll kill all the Chinese dudes that are fighting us, which would be really nice, right, if you're fighting an opposing army, and won't kill any of our guys. The problem with this premise is it never works.
Because it seems like it's pretty dangerous to try.
Well, it's very dangerous, but the thing is, it never works, because what ends up happening is that all pathogens shift over time. But one of the reasons that people think they can get away with this is that there are viruses that have very stable genomes, and measles is one of them. And so measles is also arguably the most transmissible virus ever known to mankind. If you have 100 naive people, none of whom are vaccinated, and you put one guy with measles in the room, the odds are 99 of them are.
I read once that if somebody with measles walks into an empty subway car and is there for 5 minutes and walks out, it'll be in the air for like 2 hours. Anybody walks in can get it, and the person wasn't even there.
Yeah, and it's the R0, the transmission rate for measles is we literally don't know what it is. It's so high.
I read there's only one disease that the Indians gave back. And if it's true, can you name what it was?
No.
Syphilis.
Oh, I could believe that.
Napoleon wasn't too happy about that, was he?
Well, probably, you know, if you go putting things where you're not supposed to put them, I suppose that's kind of a risk, right? I mean, Capone wasn't too happy about it either, from what I understand.
Would he have gonorrhea or syphilis?
No, it was syphilis.
Really?
And of course, before antibiotics, when the primary infection was going on, there was nothing you could do about it. Now you can, but if you don't, when it comes back, the secondary infection tends to end up in your brain and kill you, it's a nasty way to go.
Well, if Kevin's still with us, I really appreciate him doing that, because obviously I have trouble figuring out the motivation of this stuff. I mean, I can see, once a guy like Hunter gets in there, it's money. But I mean,
Chief, it's Dr. Mengele crap. They truly have this megalomaniacal idea that they are the saviors of the world, and the monetary corruption is part of it. Fauci and what went on during the early days of AIDS, Burroughs, and boy, does this have a resonance in what happened with COVID. Burroughs Wellcome came up with a drug called AZT. It was intended for cancer treatment. That was its original indication. It failed clinical trials, and one of the reasons it failed trials was that it did critical damage to the bone marrow, and essentially screwed your immune system, which if you're fighting cancer is the very last thing you want to have happen, right?
Yeah.
So it failed during failed on safety. Okay. Well, then AIDS shows up and Fauci pushes this to the exclusion of everything else. It was at the time the most expensive prescribed drug ever in the U.S. pharmacopoeia.
I remember that.
The company made a god-awful amount of money. It didn't save a single person because it didn't actually work. But what it did, the really bad part, was that during the early days of that particular virus's run, the testing was defective. So we frequently told gay men who had weird crap going on that they had HIV when they really didn't. And if you took AZT, it gave you AIDS because it destroyed your immune system and your marrow. So you could literally not have the virus and get killed by the results.
Now, hold on a minute.
Why do I say this has echoes of what happened during COVID? Because remdesivir was exactly the same sort of F-up for money. Remdesivir was also an attempt at a cancer drug. It failed on safety. The reason is in a significant percentage, about 1 in 5 persons, it damaged or destroyed your kidney function. All right? So it was shelved. Then when Ebola showed up, they tried to use it because they thought it had antiviral properties. They ran a trial with Ebola, which was halted because more people died in the trial arm than nothing.
How many of these drugs, Anastin was one of those too, right? It was a drug looking for a disease and never found one?
Yeah, this happens all the time because drugs, a huge percentage of drugs that people, you know, someone comes up with a compound, they think it's going to work in some way, and it fails very early on in phase 1 on safety. It causes so much damage that nobody in their right mind would take it, all right? And so it gets halted at that point, and that's it, and it gets thrown away. But at this point, the company spent millions of dollars, or sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, on the development. But the compound is now a known compound. And you have these crazy people within the NIH that, and Fauci was arguably the worst of this group, that would, anytime something new went on, they drag this old crap back out because there's a financial incentive to do it.
Was there any connection? I mean,
this was mRNA as well.
Yeah, well, the same thing with the mRNA was for 20 years, companies had been trying to make this work against cancer. All right, well, we take more risk than anything else because if you do nothing and you have cancer, you die, obviously, duh. So, you know, we tolerate levels of risk that we would never tolerate in any other medication. And that's okay within that context. But mRNA shots had failed on safety trials every single time they were run. And then all of a sudden, in 2020, we got another use for this. And not only did that end up licensed, which is crazy given what, and you know, people say, oh, well, you know, look, it's a, and there's this new study that just came out that said, oh, it actually is cardioprotective, that blankety blanket is. But anyway, not only that, but now you have these guys trying to reformulate all the flu shots into this form.
Is there any connection, Kevin, when you went back with the Fauci stuff? It seems like the guy did enough bad stuff, but was there any connection at all in the AIDS era? And I don't want to beat this one up, but there's rumors about that certain people in the country who were, you know, think like, you know, gays should be shot or something, thought that AIDS only affected gays, and there was some sort of a, some people were kind of dragged.
There was a very, very right-wing, religious right, thought that that it was God's punishment for being gay, but I don't think that was ever mainstream.
No, I'm not saying it was, but Fauci was never any part of that, was he?
Not that I know of. The problem, Chief, is that this stuff fundamentally collides with money seeking and rent seeking. behavior.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? Well, yeah, go figure, right? And the monopolist view that we have, and the fact that we allow the government to hand out exemptions from the from strict liability when it comes to this sort of thing. You just saw this happen with the Supreme Court decision that came out on glyphosate, okay, which is related to this, surprisingly enough, big shock, right? Where a guy got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. There is some evidence in the scientific literature that glyphosate exposure is related to that. Go figure, it's a fairly strong chemical, right? Disrupts plant metabolism. That's how it works.
You're talking about Roundup?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And glyphosate, by the way, it's in a lot of other herbicides that are not called Roundup, but the chemical itself is what the issue is. And the registration, so in the United States, there's a law that any pesticide, herbicide, or rodenticide, so, kill the three things you don't want around, right?
Yeah.
And all of those have to be registered with the EPA, and they have a registration number. And if you look at any of those things in the store, you're going to Lowe's or Home Depot, whatever, you look at it, there's a registration number on the label of each of any of these things, all right? All of those items have to be registered. The law states that the manufacturer must have on the label the warnings and the cautions that are defined by that registration statement and nothing else. And by the way, it's considered a mislabeled and misbranded product if there's anything else on there or if anything's omitted. So, and there are criminal penalties for doing that.
For who?
For the company.
Yeah, well, so when was the last time that happened?
Well, Chief, point being, the EPA's registration statement says these are the risks you must warn about. You may not warn of anything that isn't on that label, and you must warn of all the things that are.
Well, the fly in that ointment is if Kevin sprays it on his yard, the guy next door is not reading the label.
Why?
Nor is the person who makes the purchase in the first place.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. Exactly. I understand this, and okay, fine. But here's the basic issue is that the person who sued, and this ultimately ended up in front of the Supremes, said that there are a series of state laws that says that you can't sell things with undisclosed but known risks. Okay, all right. So in other words, you can't hide the sausage, so to speak. Yeah. Right. And he sued under this because da da da, and the Supreme Court came back and said, wait a minute now. You're basically telling a manufacturer that they can't, that they what is their option? They can't put the warning, even if they know about it, even if there's outside scientific evidence of it, and they're aware of it. They can't put it on there because under existing federal law, and this is a substance sold in interstate commerce, therefore the interstate commerce exception is part of this. It's under federal jurisdiction. Federal law says the label may not contain anything other than what's in the registration statement when it comes to warnings.
That's special.
Well, okay, but you know what? Your beef isn't with the state, right? Your beef is with the EPA that registered that substance. And that's why they threw it out. Now, social media is screaming about this. Okay, guess what? We have a corrupt set of... look at the endangerment finding. All right,
we have a corrupt set EPA, and we have corrupt people in the Supreme Court. Where else you want to go?
Well, I'm just saying, okay, but, the same thing happened with the endangerment finding. Carbon dioxide is an existential threat to the,
yeah,
to life on Earth. The hell it is. But that was finally tossed, okay, after it went through the review. It was just recently thrown out. But that was, again, a corrupt finding pressed by a bunch of social justice warriors who wanted to see a particular thing. You know, you've got people screaming right now over in England and France because it's warm. Gee, it's summer, right? that has its way happening.
I actually have a pushback on you on the carbon dioxide thing because.
You can push back all you want. The facts.
No,
I'm facts.
Okay, but you're talking. Your assumption is carbon dioxide in air, right?
Well, carbon dioxide is in the air you exhale.
I understand it, but one of Kevin and my more Mike because he was my age, my roommate, who went on to become a PhD chemist and worked for NOAA till he retired. Mm-hmm. You'd love this job, Carl. He was one of the guys in the DC-8s going across the poles looking for the ozone holes and stuff. And he was also part of a group that charted oxygen blooms. I told you the story. Oxygen blooms, or essentially oxygen levels everywhere in the world. You know, the idea that God, I'm not saying we should lose the jungle, but he said the oxygen. You fly across the jungle because there's no oxygen bloom. It's in equilibrium. For every tree that's pumping out oxygen, there's a tree on the ground with 9 zillion termites pumping out carbon dioxide. So it ends up in equilibrium. He said the most incredible oxygen bloom they ever found was 2 years after the big fires in Yellowstone, when everything was new. He said that the needle almost went through the end of the scope.
Oh yeah, well,
what I'm getting to is he said for some reason, and if he was on the air, he would agree with you, but he said for some reason, even a little more carbon dioxide in seawater seems to make a huge difference. And in coral reefs and stuff like that, and nobody, he said, yeah, in the air, what's the difference? You know, well, a little bit more. I mean, it's in soda pop, for God's sake. Somehow or another, it has a problem in seawater. And I don't know, I mean, I didn't talk to him long enough to find out if they've come to any kind of an idea as to why that might be or something. I have no idea. I'm no chemist. But, you know, just a quick one on the AIDS.
Well, it is, but it isn't. So I do understand the reasons for this, and that is that carbon dioxide, when it dissolves, by the way, this is why you're all alive. Carbon dioxide dissolves in water to some extent, okay? And when it does, it produces it as with all things in a polar solvent, which water does. It's the same thing with salt. When you put salt into water, you don't have NaCl anymore as a substance, okay? So salt in a little pile on your desk is NaCl. When you put it in water and it dissolves, it actually disassociates. So you have sodium ions and chlorine ions. Okay, carbon dioxide does the same thing and makes carbonic acid. So that's what you actually have when it's dissolved in water. Now, the reason that's absolutely critical for life and is why you're alive and breathe and you can go out and you can play basketball or ski or run or whatever is that your breathing drive, your respiratory drive, occurs as a consequence of very tiny shifts in pH in your blood, which the stem of your brain is capable of sensing and responding to almost instantly. So when you exert yourself, when your body's cells consume ATP and oxygen, they produce carbon dioxide that is dissolved in the blood's carbonic acid that shifts your pH and that drives respiration. As you increase your breathing rate, the amount of dissolved carbon dioxide in your blood falls, the shift in pH slightly the other way occurs, and that causes you to relax in terms of your breathing drive. There is a backup with oxygen concentration in the blood. People that have COPD end up using that instead because the other part is damaged. But that is very slow, and you could not, that's the reason that people have COPD basically can't exercise, because they can't respond quickly enough and they'll pass out. But that is the whole thing with the oceans and the balance. It really is about that pH shift, and it comes from the dissolved carbon dioxide.
I'm going to real quick story on the AIDS thing and one of the
quick story. Yeah. Do it, and then I'm going to put a bow on what the stuff I said and go away. So,
all right, and then I want to talk about money supply, which is horrendous, which is always a great topic.
Yeah, and I want to bring up some stuff about the MicroStrategy stuff too, because you brought that up early.
Back when the this age was happening, you know, I was trading for, you know, a couple of guys that had it, so it was kind of the Time or Newsweek or one of those people. I mean, Dr. J and I always just got two or three of those magazines because that's where the news was in those days, and I miss them, but those stories. But one of them, I don't know, it was Time or somebody, you got this thing and it looked like it was a phone book. It wasn't that thick, but they went through and had in the middle of there, because because we were talking about, you know, this AIDS is just a gay disease and blah, blah, blah. They had the faces of AIDS. The people who were dying from AIDS, it was especially in California, because there was no test for the AIDS virus in the blood.
Right.
All these people. You know who died a horrible death from AIDS was Amanda Blake from Gunsmoke.
Blood transfusion. Yeah, blood transfusions were, they didn't have testing, and anybody that had hemophilia basically wiped out everybody with hemophilia in the United States.
Yeah, you just went through a few of these pages, you couldn't go through anymore. It was just horrible.
Well, the other thing, though, that they were doing during the time, because this was, all of this really hit during the time that I was coming of age. What all of the so-called medical experts were pushing really hard was that any person you slept with was going to kill you.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And oh, by the way, that was a complete lie.
Well,
which was later proved.
Watch
now. It wasn't that it was zero risk, but what they tried to drill into your head was a complete load of BS.
Well, the people that are a little older than me, if you watch that movie with Jim Belushi about last night. But Division Street and everybody go out every night and coming home with a different partner.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of the way the world was before AIDS. And then afterward, not so much.
Oh, look. But there's like a 2,000-to-1 skew in risk between one particular thing and everything
Kevin,
else.
Kevin, finish up your stuff. You did an amazing job here this morning, by the way.
All right. Well, the last thing I want to say is that everything that happened was part of the cover-up.
Yeah,
when you start thinking of all of the bullshit mitigations that we had, all of them, that was part of the cover-up. The vaccines that didn't work, that actually do damage to people, part of the cover-up. The masks. The masks, yeah, that's the mitigations. The masks, the social distancing, the lockdowns, all of that was part of the cover-up. The money that got piled onto the deficit was a result of the cover-up. How many businesses failed during that whole madness? People who lost their businesses and therefore their livelihoods and their life savings on that. What lasting effect did we have on young people who were in school at the time that couldn't go to school? What have we done to their social skills? The elderly and terminally ill people who could not connect with their loved ones. The divisiveness that was created throughout the society, all of that was part of the cover-up.
Kevin, I think you know how right you are. It's so scary.
And this is the true evil of Anthony Fauci, is that all of that was allowed to go on because he could not give ground and be exposed.
Kevin, yep. I think you're right, buddy.
No, he is right, and I don't know if you remember the Lethal Weapon movie where the guy pulls out his password, diplomatic immunity. It's just been revoked.
God. Well, Kevin, are you? There no soccer now next week. It's all everybody's all placed.
Oh, you got me.
Well, we'll have Mike on next Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean that schedule's online. That's easy to find.
I'd rather when he tells it. It's always a better story when he tells it.
Well, yeah, it can be. So, yeah, we'll have Mike back on Wednesday.
All right. By the way, no show next Friday.
It's be show and a good weekend, and I will be in touch.
All right, we're going to head off to break. SP Futures down 26. SP Futures down 320. And then I'm going to bring some of these money supply numbers to Carl, and he's got some stuff. But our new Fed chair, it's got an odd way of fighting inflation. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Blowing up back, Stocks and Jocks. Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 28 and NASDAQ Futures down 330. Ricky, the numbers are exactly the same as when we walked in, but they haven't budged. It's pretty scary, or unusual or something.
It is indeed.
Over in Asia, we've got, now these guys have been up, down all around. And I think today is no different. As soon as my machine went, so I got so much stuff on here with money supplies and federal. Nikkei's down 3,000. That's 4%. They're up yesterday, but I think they're down more today. They were up yesterday. Hang Seng down 4,605. That's 1.7%. That's a lot. Shanghai down 93. That's 2.25%. You very seldom see those guys move that much, but they are down today. We're in Europe. DAX down 298, 1.2%. Puts it down 91.9%. CAC around down 56.7. So down there as well. We have bonds unchanged here at 4.39. UK's up 0.4% at 4.74. The Bund is unchanged at 2.85. Oil, which is down 211, but it shot back up a little bit with that container ship that supposedly got fired. I don't know about supposedly. Maybe did get. But now it's back below 70 at 69.81. RBOB down 6 cents, 295. Again, throw a 60 to a buck 10 number on that with taxes, and that's what you're paying, which I think everybody already knows. Gold up 13 bucks, 4,061, back over 4,000. Silver down 16 cents, 58.20. Foreign exchange, and this has really kind of been the story. The dollar is still, well, the dollar is, euro's back over 114. It was under 114, which is really something, since it's been 117 plus for quite a while. British pound 132, it's higher than it was yesterday. The yen, however, 161.67. Markets very wary of yen intervention risk. 160 is the number with Japan. We'll cover this a little bit. 161.67, those guys are in panic. This is one I got to dig with Carl on this. Bitcoin's up 580 today to 59,789. I'm very worried about this, not because I have crypto, but because I think it's a problem if it goes much lower. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:35 here in Chicago. We're looking at 64 degrees right now with a high of 66. Mostly cloudy and much cooler with a couple of showers today. Tonight we'll be partly cloudy with a low of 61 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 89 degrees right now with a high of 111. Mostly sunny and dangerous heat. Tonight will be clear skies with a low of 85 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, slow ramp to inbound Dan Ryan from Stevenson, so you can expect a little bit of a delay there. All of the major expressways are moving at posted speed. Inbound Kennedy from Monroe is 10 minutes. We're looking at 23 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook. Eisenhower from Wolf is 20 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th, 16 minutes. And lastly, 24 minutes. Inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan. Now for the MLB. Yesterday, the Cubs beat Mets 4-3, and Diamondbacks Cardinals were postponed due to inclement weather. Makeup date is July 23rd. Now for the FIFA World Cup, the United States took their first loss in the tournament against Turkey, who beat them 3-2. Despite the loss, they still move on to round of 32 as first place winner in Group D. They will face Bosnia on July 1st. That's all I got for you, Chief. Back over to you.
Ricky, who is the other team in the Bosnia game?
What do you mean, the other team?
They played last night, Kansas City.
Oh, I think you're thinking of Qatar, maybe? No.
Well, the reason why is, I don't know how these guys do this. To me, it seems all bleeped up. You know, you got 48 teams, you only cut down to 32, but some of the groups take two and some of the groups take three. And the team the U.S. is playing, whoever they played last night,
yeah,
both were going to get in.
So the
winner, yes, of the game last night would have to play Spain, who nobody wants to play, and the loser got to play the U.S., who everybody wants to play. So the idea was put out there that both teams want to lose this game and how horrible it was for the sport. and I didn't watch it, but I don't know what was on. But I mean, I wonder how bad it was, because both teams wanted to lose.
Yeah, well, you know, they played Australia, but the thing is that, I mean, if what you're saying is true, you know, it's Australia or United States that are playing Spain, you definitely want to avoid Spain as much as
you want.
That's
what I mean. So Australia must have won, so they're playing Spain.
Yeah, well, they're number two right now. They're playing the first one of the other group, so yeah, they're playing Spain. So yeah, that's bye-bye for Australia, I would say.
So the other guys did a better job at tanking.
Yeah, I guess you could say that, yeah.
Oh, God. All right, Carl, I'll lab this out, and we'll talk anywhere, but we got the new Fed chairman who's pounding the table, put a bunch of committees together. He sounded like Mayor Daley. We're going to remand this to committee. And now, but he's going to really do this inflation. He's going to really make people block and tackle, the new head coach. Well, I've got the April to May number annualized at 13%, March to May at 9.7, and February to May at 7.5. That is gasoline on the fire. What in God's name is he talking about?
Oh, come on. It's not gasoline. He's throwing sticks of TNT around. I mean, good God.
Actually, I think their bottles of nitroglycerin.
Can you believe any of these people?
Well, no. Here's the essence of the problem, though. And, you know, I sent that article around that's on the top of... It's actually the top pinned article on my blog now, which is the chondritis level cycle on raids that he is attempting to prevent from happening.
By the way, anybody who doesn't should check out Carl's blog. It's really, really good.
What he's trying to do is prevent a long wave cycle from occurring. Now, by the way, so did Powell.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, that was the game coming out of 2008, which I've pointed out before. If you take a look at the spread between the effective Fed funds rate and the deficit as a percent of GDP, never prior to that time had there ever been a durable period. It had been short term, you know, during serious recessions and stuff like this, but never had there been a durable period of time where the effective Fed funds rate was lower than the deficit as a percent of GDP. Okay, just never happened. Not even back into the 1950s and 1960s. It never happened before. And all of a sudden we have this, at this point, you know, 15-year period, right, where they tried to do this. They all knew coming out of that period of time that this cycle had ended, and they've been trying to prevent that from happening. But here's why it's futile, and it will fail, and is failing now. And now you've got the wheels really spinning, trying to keep the truck car from going over
the
cliff.
Okay, right? Wait 1 second before you, you're talking like an economist, and you're talking like somebody who cares about all people.
No, Chief,
Go ahead, because you're going to draw a conclusion that I think these guys are drawing a different conclusion. Go ahead.
No, it doesn't. Look, mathematics don't care about your politics. They don't care about what party you are. They don't care about your goals.
They care about if you're long real estate and long stock.
No, Chief. You could. This is not how exponents work. The laws of mathematics don't bend because you have a political goal or a socioeconomic goal. And you want to benefit one person to screw everybody else, okay? You could play this kind of game, but all you do is compound the damage. And if you want to see where it's shown up first, and by the way, the reason it's shown up here first is because the federal government, during this period of slammed to the floor rates, aggressively walked down the curve on duration for Treasury debt. Very aggressively,
which was really dumb, but they did.
By the way, it was really stupid. Okay, but it was done for political reasons to try to hold down the deficit.
To those
numbers.
That don't know what the hell we're talking about, when interest rates got to 1%, you would think you would have gone out to 30-year as far as you could.
But you would have had to pay 2.5 or 3.
Yeah.
Okay, and people said, "Oh, but one's better than 3."
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. So the problem with this, the problem with this, though, Chief, is if you look at interest expense, it has gone vertical within the federal government. Okay, it was always increasing, but as long as it increases at a lower rate than GDP expands, it's manageable. And in a world of so-called 2% inflation is what we're supposed to stability.
I am interrupting, but I'm not, because when you say stuff like that, I just want to define for everybody what you're talking about. New vintage economics, the story is national debt doesn't matter. The idea is that if the national debt is growing, a zillionth less than your economy is growing, just extend yourself out 50 years and it's all done. But the problem with that is when you start lying about the national debt, you start lying about the inflation, and you never actually do that, then you got a real problem, is what you're saying.
Well, right? Okay. What I'm saying is that deferring taking the recognition of what you've done,
yes,
does not make it less or equally the same. All it does is compound the damage. The laws of mathematics, when it comes to exponents, you cannot evade them.
Right.
There is no way around it. You can stop doing stupid things whenever you want, But until you do, the stupidity is going to compound.
If you did, this guy Best, who was the Secretary of Treasury, could be the biggest liar I've ever come across. If we actually did grow 3%, and the national debt grew 2%, that could work extended out 20 years. But it they don't count it right, and they lie, so it never works.
Well, okay, but the point being, what you saw, and what you could go take a look at, okay, and again, I put the graphs up from Fred. Okay, these are official data out of the Federal Reserve. The acceleration, the vertical acceleration in interest expense within the U.S. Treasury, the reason it all occurred in that kind of a way is because Treasury aggressively rolled down the tenor of their debt issuance. In other words, they went from 10 years to roll as much down into 13-week and 26-week bills as they could, okay? And you know, where you had 10s, okay, now it's 2s, you know, this kind of thing, right? All the way down to the IRS, cash management bills.
Right, what you're talking about, though, if they would have done that, which I agree with you.
Well, they did do that.
If they would have stayed further out, it made more sense.
Right.
Okay, it sounds like, you know, who's the we in this? You got a mouse in your pocket? They would have done better, but the poor bastard who would have bought the stuff at 2.5% to 30-year bonds and have inflation go to 5 or 6.
Yo, we'll get it.
He's getting it right where the sun don't shine. So there's a loser here somewhere.
Okay, but hold on a minute, Chief. Here's why this is important for the economy and for the markets as a whole. Okay, what you see now is the acceleration of that. The problem is this: all you did was accelerate when this shows up in that table.
Correct.
In the corporate world, when you are in a generally declining rate environment, so you're going from the upper left of the chart to the lower right, yes, there are countercyclical times when, you know, okay, rates are going up, even though in the long-term basis they're going down, but there are periods of time when they go up anyway. These sorts of things tend to correlate with the initiation of recessions. They tend to correlate with companies blowing up. Exploiting that, if you've got cash and you don't have leverage on, or you can get more leverage, and if you're a big company you can, or you're a little company you can't without getting it in the pants. But
what do you mean? You get a credit card.
22% interest.
Yep.
So the problem is the guys in charge of actually distributing things, like the credit card companies, make damn sure that you and I cannot profit from those counter trend things,
right,
unless you have cash. Okay. Now, in the 1990s, one of the reasons I refused to lever up MCS was because I wanted to be able to take advantage of those things, and a couple of times I was able to do it, and that was tremendously helpful to my operating margins.
By the way, right? Cash is nowhere near as good as the being able to borrow like the big guys in the government.
Yeah, but you know what? I can't. So, you know, as a small business person, you're not going to have that capability. And if you try it and you catch the cycle wrong, you're going to get destroyed.
All right, again, back up here to explain what I just said.
Now, hold on.
Give me a second. If Carl puts $1 million cash into a business and he returns 10%, it's nowhere near as good as putting 500 in, borrowing the 500 at 3%, and then making 10%. It's not even close.
But there's an exception to that, Chief, and that is if all of a sudden, because I have the cash and a company has a bunch of office space and I need it because I've run out of room, okay, and that firm is in a large office building that's about to violate its lending.
Right, now you're turning Warren Buffett on me. If you got cash nobody else does, that's another advantage. Yes.
Well, I'm just saying, all of a sudden I can get office space at $8 a square foot that everyone else has been paying $40 for.
Right.
That does a monstrously good thing to my operating income number when I get to the end of the year.
But you see what you're missing.
Chief, that's where it matters. All right, now here's why it matters.
You forgot the part. You could do both. Resolution Trust. If you were a friend of George Bush.
Chief,
They let you the money, and they sold it to you at 8 cents on the dollar.
But Chief, I didn't blow George Bush.
No, well,
okay, and I can't get into that club. So since I'm not in that club, that's not a choice.
Yep, I know.
I can play the leverage game, but if it goes bad on me, I get blown up. Whereas if I don't play it, I take advantage of other people that do blow up, and now that's a little more reliable, okay? And in the meantime, I can finance, as long as I can finance my operations from cash flow, I'm okay. Now, here's why it matters, though, from a government and corporate and equity standpoint and stock market standpoint. During that last 40-year period, which basically everyone who's in the market today and everyone who's running a business today, it's all they know because it started in the early 1980s.
Yep.
Corporations have never paid bonds off. They've always rolled them. Why? Because if I've got a 5% bond out, and now it's 4, by God, I'm a genius, okay? I can roll it over, and my interest expense goes down. Therefore, my operating income goes up, my PE goes up, because stocks are a levered bet on operating income, basically, okay? Now, of course, we've decoupled that, because in a mania, that's what happens. But generally speaking, that's how it works. The problem is this. When that long-term trend reverses, and it now conclusively has, those corporate tenants...
It has a while ago. I mean,
the whole thing in 2020 was slamming rates back to zero and handing out checks and everything else. It was an attempt to prevent that cycle from asserting itself. What ended up... But the problem is, when you do that into a cycle that has turned, what you get is hideous inflation. Duh, that's exactly what we got. Okay, you handed out checks to everybody. You didn't. The absorption mechanisms were consumed. That's the reason the cycle turned in the first place. You can't do anything about that because they're gone. There is no built-in absorption mechanism remaining. The first place it showed up was on the federal interest expense. But the problem is the only reason it showed up there first is because they rolled down duration. Corporations, generally speaking, did some of it, but not to as stupid of a degree as the federal government by any stretch of the imagination. But the average tenor out there on corporate debt that is now starting to roll is about 10 years. And we're 5 years into this. And now you're starting to see this. Oracle is getting into some trouble with this stuff. It's one of the reasons Oracle's not been doing so great lately. All right? Because... You don't have to retain any earnings to pay those bonds off. Well, we'll just roll them the next. Well, that's great until the rate demanded is 2% higher than the last time around instead of 2% lower, right? Well, this is going to roll through the entire corporate world, and there isn't anything that can be done to prevent it. It's going to happen, and it's already happening. And if you look at what just happened with SpaceX, all right? I put this up on the thing, whether or not you looked at the tenor of this bond ladder that they put out. They come out, they do this huge IPO. Now they got $80 billion. Okay, that's a hell of a lot of money by anybody's standard.
Yeah, one would think, yeah.
Well, okay, so what do? They turn around and they file and manage to get subscribed another 20 in bonds. And it wasn't one tranche. It was a series, it was a ladder of bonds. And even on the short end, these guys were paying in the fives.
Really?
All right. Yeah. And at the long end, now they have some stuff that's pretty far. I mean, as a percentage, it's not a huge amount of the offering, but still, they've got some stuff that's, it's about 20, 30 years. And there, they're in the mid sixes and better. All right, now this is a company that has $8 billion on the balance sheet.
In six months, it'll be a steal, probably.
Well, I'll tell you what. Either these guys are the smartest people in the room, for real, because they think the long rate's going to 10.
Well, yeah.
Well, okay. Or if they're wrong on that, then... everybody else gets destroyed and inflation is 15. All right. Now, this is, and what people need to understand is that when that rollover gets into people and they have to start doing it at the corporate level, plenty of these companies will survive it because they have operating revenue. However, it's going to hit their earnings because that interest expense comes directly off the top, and there's nothing you can do about that. So this is where the squeeze comes from. And if you want to see how bad it's going to get, all you got to do is look at that interest expense line for the federal government.
They are in the group. This is why inflation is so dangerous, because there are winners and there are losers.
But if you think
SpaceX, I guarantee you, if you could dig into Musk's mind, he's going to say, if there's a lot of inflation, by the way, this 13% I've talked about in his money supply growth, mind you, during the Civil War, we were at 10%.
No, I understand.
I mean, so this 13% is a massive number.
And compounded, by the way, it's ruinous immediately.
Yeah, but I'm saying is the Musks of the world. And you're seeing, by the way, if you're watching Microsoft, which I do because I have a lot of it under management, and Apple, which I have some, they're on the back end of this. When the Micron guy came out and said, don't worry, the revenues are going to keep going up because these prices are going to keep going up. The two stocks that went down are Microsoft and Apple, because they're buyers of the stuff.
Well, they're mandatory buyers.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And here's the thing that comes with this, okay? This is where the collapse comes from. This is where the fallback originates. And I have warned of this for quite some time, because the AI stuff, problem with this is, this demand is artificial. And I'm not saying people aren't buying the chips. They are, okay? So don't take this as meaning something other than what it actually means. What I mean by the demand is artificial is, these are companies buying up the stuff. They're buying up the chips. They're placing, the orders are real. However, no one in that space currently has a positive operating revenue number. No one.
No, that's a problem.
Well, at some point, someone gets up in the morning and says, excuse me, okay? And when they do, this entire thing collapses. And the problem is that the external, and this is where it's way worse and going to be way worse than what happened in 2000 and 2008. In 2000, the damage was mostly confined to those companies that had gone out and tried to claim that they were going to make 10 times GDP over the next 5 years.
Well, okay. But here's
the thing, Chief. The damage now is immediate, and it's in companies like Apple that make things you buy.
But they're also Apple's. But I guess what I'm saying here, Carl, the attitude of these people. I mean, I'm on the other end of the attitude of this, by the way. I know that if our inflation next year is 10%, there's no way in hell PTI is raising commissions and management's fees by 12%. That ain't happening. It hasn't happened in our business in forever. So I already know when this happens, we're a net loser. But I guarantee if you drilled into Musk's head, or the guy who owns NVIDIA, or the guy who owns Micron, they're going to say, you know what, if inflation goes 10%, I don't care. Because recent history has shown, and my ego has shown, our revenues will be up 15. We're okay with this.
And Chief, in a generally declining rate environment, this works.
Yeah, but
that is no longer true.
My point is, it's. I know it's not true for everybody, but
it's
it
not
is true
for anyone.
Sure, it is.
Okay, you're in for a surprise. If these guys are going to get away with this, I'm telling you right now, they're not.
I didn't say they were. My point is, in the last 4 months, however long we've been fighting this war, I got people that are long Chevron. They're not complaining.
Look, I don't care about the next 4 months.
I'm with you. I'm just saying.
I'm going to live, I hope, more than 4 months into the future.
I'm agreeing with you. That's why. But the point is, I'm trying to accentuate the amount of winners and losers in inflation and in deficit it's dramatic.
And that's how it always starts, and that's why people think it can continue, because there's some people that are making bank and they think it's wonderful and it's going to keep being that way and it's going to stay and everything's going to be beautiful and roses and puppies.
Well, Kyle, you're absolutely right. The dude at Micron's forgetting the part that if everybody else goes down a rat hole, the orders from Microsoft and Apple aren't going to be the same. Duh.
Well, gee, yeah. If Apple all of a sudden has a 10% loss in new orders for the next iPhone,
yeah,
By the way, is that kind of memory? Is that the kind of memory that's in the iPhone? And they mentioned the laptops. And
well,
the other
there's
stuff.
There's different. So there's different. Yeah, it's not the same, but it all ties back to the same companies, okay? Because there's only three or four companies that actually make all the stuff. Micron's one of them. SK Hynix is another.
Because Apple specifically mentioned the desktops and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, the biggest impact is coming there, okay? I mean, the RAM sticks that I have in my desktop machine. I paid $100 for
when you
that.
Say RAM sticks, you're talking about the things of the RAMs that go in the slot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The sticks. They cost me $100.
I never heard them referred to as sticks. You mean the things where you slide them in there and all of a sudden you got more RAM?
Yeah, they're sticks.
Okay. Okay.
They look like a stick.
All right.
Okay. The specific type that my board uses and the machine that's on my desk that I'm talking to you through, when I bought them, they were $100. Okay. Now, that exact same pair of sticks. There's two of them in there. They were $100 for both of them. That same pair of sticks today is $500.
I was gonna say same time when I bought a computer. Next time I go computer, I want you to go shopping with me, will you? Because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. They added like two or three in there. I think it was an extra $100 or something.
Yeah, it was. And that's normally in a commodity market. That's what tends to happen, right? Things get cheaper, you know, whatever. Okay. So this distortion is why the SOX is, you know, done a vertical rocket shot, right? But the problem with this is that this demand is all based upon an on-the-come view of what's going to happen with AI data centers and AI as a model. And nobody today is actually turning a positive operating income. So everyone, EBITDA, you're not even positive there,
yeah.
Right? All right, no one has a positive operating income. All right, that is a problem because...
Well, Carl, even you'd have confidence if people won you $100 billion in the last 5 days.
Well, Chief, it only works, but the sustainability of it and the continued acceleration of the market and the continued acceleration of this only works as long as the market continues to hand out debt to these people and allow them to continue to issue on credit, which is what all of it is. When that stops, and it will, because eventually if you're lighting $100 bills on fire out and back, somebody's going to say, hey, wait a minute, how am I ever going to get paid back, right? When that occurs, all of this is going to violently unwind. And if you want to see where it comes from, all you got to do is look at that interest expense graph for the federal government. It's coming to all of corporate America over the next 2 to 3 years. And there isn't anything you can do to stop
it. By the way, now, not only that, do you see it? $47 billion that homeowners dug out of their house equity in the first quarter. By the way,
you're going to be lucky if the collapse in housing prices stops at 50% on average.
Would you mind on Tuesday, and I know...
I want to get one more thing, Chief.
Okay, go ahead. I'm not cutting you off. I'm not cutting you off.
No, you raised this right at the beginning of the show, and I want to make sure people understand this. MicroStrategy.
That's just what I was going to ask.
Yeah, and Saylor. All right. MicroStrategy itself does not pay a dividend. However, it has two dividend-paying preferreds that they've issued that trade separately. Strike, which is STRK, is a perpetual preferred that pays an 8% annual dividend on a quarterly basis. And all of that has been funded from the acceleration in Bitcoin price.
So why would anybody put out a preferred when the other stuff is deductible?
Chief, I'm just telling you what this guy did, okay? The company at this below about 60,000,
which is where we are,
Bitcoin, which is about where we are. The way that they've laddered and structured this, it runs in reverse. As things stand today, the base company MSTR has about 10 months worth of cash reserves to continue to pay that preferred. Preferred is not like a dividend from a common stock where you can cut it. Doesn't work that way.
Well, there's some that are you can catch up on. What do they call that?
The firm will blow up if it runs out of cash.
Okay, just since I mentioned that, there are preferreds where you cannot pay the dividend, but before you pay a common dividend, you got to pay. You got to catch up.
You got to pay the preferred, yeah. Right? You got to catch up. The problem is, if you run out of operating income, you're dead.
Well, where does a place like Robinhood or Coinbase, when they go, if I wanted to buy Bitcoin, somehow they get me a margin loan. Where are they getting that from? They're not going to the same bank, RBC or IB, is to get the loan on IBM. Who's giving you the loan on Bitcoin?
Well, I don't know, but you know what somebody is, and part of this, you know, Saylor, this is the thing about turning leverage cranks. When you have a leveraged bet, and the underlying whatever it is that you're levered against is going up in price, you look like a damn genius because you put the multiplier on it going that direction.
All right, so we only got a second, but real quick, let's talk more on Tuesday. But not a prediction. Bitcoin goes to 10,000 tomorrow. Who's hurt? Drug dealers, people in Puerto Rico, some small countries. Where is the risk?
Well, anyone who has levered against it. Now, MSTR probably goes kaboom immediately.
I would say that. Yeah.
Okay. But there's a whole bunch of other entities out there.
I mean, we're talking Russian oligarchs. I mean, who's
no,
got this crap?
I think you're talking about general market liquidity, which is exactly where it is. Okay, this is part of the problem that happened in 2008. All right, I mean, who thought Lehman Brothers? Yeah. I mean, we knew about the two hedge funds that blew up early in 07, right? In the summer of 07 with Bear Stearns.
Yeah, one of them was one of our clients, and I never put two and two together.
Well, but I mean, but people were like, oh, well, okay, those guys took the most risky tranches. They were highly geared, yeah. and it unwound on them, and they exploded. Okay, so what? Then Bear Stearns itself explodes. All right. And then some months later after, oh, everything's fine, you know, the central banks, yeah, it's all good, whatever. At the same time, Citibank knows Lehman's bankrupt in August because they tried to do a tri-party repo and didn't have any more collateral. They physically knew, they factually knew Lehman was bankrupt, all right? So, of course, if you happen to be on that trading desk, you think you might short them?
Well, there was also, we got a day, Russell was about a few months later, what was the... The mid-level bank in Germany that just blew up. It's like, how did those guys get involved in it?
Well, this is the thing with Bitcoin, okay, is that I don't know precisely where all that leverage is, and I don't think anybody else does either. We're going to find out.
Maybe. Hey, bud, have a nice weekend. Tuesday, we got our 45 minutes. No show again next Friday, bud.
I can't, yeah, I'm missing my car. Yeah, I know. That's all right. I'll be shooting off firecrackers.
Oh, there you go. S&P Futures down 43. NASDAQ Futures down 440. We were hanging right even for about the first hour and a half of the show. Now we're ducking again down. We'll talk about it on Monday. Have a good weekend, everybody.
That's all, folks.